You're listening to Well Made, a podcast from Lumi about the people and ideas behind your favorite online brands. I'm your host, Stefan Ango. Halli, welcome to the show.
Yes, hello.
You're in Iceland right now. What time is it over there?
It's 5 p.m. and it's been a long day. I'm already like 10 hours into the day, so I'm hoping that I can keep up the energy.
What did they have there in Iceland? It's like a potato alcohol or something like that. What kind of, is it time for that yet, or is it another coffee for the evening?
I used to drink alcohol excessively every day, so I stopped doing that about 7 years ago. So right now I am drinking a lot of Coke, which is not good for me either, but it's better than alcohol. And then when I'm at my best, I'm not doing any sugar, and that's actually when my energy levels are up. But then you cheat a little bit, and then you go into this spiral.
I'm on Los Angeles time. It's early. I'm having my first coffee of the day, so energy levels might be slightly different. But
yeah, I don't drink coffee because I have an excessive. I do everything excessively, so I decided a long time ago not to drink coffee because I would be hopped up on coffee right
now.
Too
much coffee.
Yes.
Well, moderation is it's a good value. You're the founder of Ueno, U-E-N-O. It's a design agency that people have probably seen your work if they've been online. You've worked for a lot of incredible companies, Slack, Google, Airbnb, Uber. The client list just keeps on growing. When did Ueno get started?
I started Ueno about 4 years ago. The first office was here in Iceland, where I'm at the moment, and then we've been growing over the last few years.
And you have offices now in New York, Los Angeles, San Francisco. Where else?
And in Iceland, I think there's more offices coming, but nothing has been decided. It's most likely more in the US and Europe in the next few years. Depends on how fast we can get in the work and the clients.
Now, I want to go back in time and like walk through how you got to that, because I don't think it was like an overnight, you know, success of 4 years of just building this company. You came to it through a lot of steps, but I kind of want to work backwards and start with one of the blog posts that your team wrote a couple years ago that I found super inspirational, which was related to a value you've built into Ueno today, which is always bring the chocolate. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, so the post you're talking about was written by Robin, who was an intern at Ueno and then later joined as a full-time designer and is currently traveling the world. He used to say that if someone asks you for a cup of coffee, you should bring them a cup of coffee, but you should also bring them something extra, which is, in this metaphor, the chocolate, meaning something that they didn't know they wanted, but enhances their experience and makes it more enjoyable or adds something that they didn't know they were looking for.
And so how does that relate to client work? How does that relate to, I guess, personal values in life? And like, why did that make it into the like five important values that you have at Ueno?
There was another one that when we were writing the values, there was another one that I was thinking about, which is sort of in some ways similar, but wasn't as catchy, which was bump the light, which comes from Roger Rabbit. When they were making Roger Rabbit, there was a scene when Roger is fighting the detective. And in the scene, because it's partly animated and it's partly live action, they obviously have to do a lot of technical things. But in one of the scenes, he's fighting Roger and he bumps Roger into a light, which means that the light source for the whole scene is changing, which means that if you work with animation, the scene becomes infinitely more complex, but they thought it added depth and they thought it would be worth the extra work to do it. So both of those kind of come at it from different angles. But for me, it's really just about going the extra mile, which is sort of the cliche way of saying it. So we wanted something that said, you know, there's always a way to enhance or make anything better.
I like bump the light as well. It's an interesting one because I do think it comes from a different angle, where I think the chocolate is sort of a level of service where you're giving something extra to someone and you're trying to make it extra special. With the bump the light, I think it's more internal in a way. It's like, how can we challenge ourselves technically to do something that's like maybe harder than what was asked? Like, how can we make it harder on ourselves just because we really enjoy the challenge of it? Is that a way of looking at it?
That is, but the reason I didn't go with the Bump the Light because was, and I preferred the chocolate. Again, it was I thought it was a better metaphor and a better branding moment because we ended up actually making chocolates that we give to people. So there was something to that. But I don't necessarily want us to be a place that make things complicated for no reason, which is sort of what Bump the Light is. It's sort of, there was no great storytelling reason why they did that in the movie, but they probably added a couple of few more months of work. I do appreciate and love that they did that, and the chocolate metaphor works better because it is really enhancing the experience of the user.
So some of the other things that are on your list, we're all in this together, be raw, figure it out, nothing here is someone else's problem. And then there's actually a sixth one. I forgot that one. Life is short, enjoy it.
Yeah.
Those are really interesting. They're not, just the traditional corporate kind of values that are summarized by one word that doesn't mean anything. What made you want to write that document that came out at some point in the past 12 months, I think? You put that together.
We do a retreat every year where the whole company comes together for a week. And leading up to the retreat, we had been working, each office had been working in isolation on sort of figuring out what it was that we wanted to stand for. But maybe backtracking further from that, I put that project in motion because at that time we were about 35, 40 people, and it was already beyond the limits of where I personally could oversee, obviously, everything. And I started to realize that it was going to be important for us to have some kind of a foundation for when we make decisions or when we have hard conversations. It's easy to say something like, do good work or, these sort of platitudes that don't mean anything. So it's good for us to have something that is unique to us, is something that is honest to who we are and who we want to be. Then the teams all got together. They kind of, in more of a sort of standard way, wrote down some words of ideas and thoughts and aspirations that they had. And then we put that all together. We ended up with these six core values that we then talk about pretty excessively internally.
You were born in Iceland. You've lived there most of your life. Your company has a certain DNA that comes from Iceland, but now a lot of your employees are in the United States as well. Do you think some of these values come from your Icelandic heritage to some extent, or how are they informed?
I think, yes, I do think there's something in there that is, I don't know if uniquely Icelandic, but at least influenced by being from Iceland. First value is that we're all in this together, and that is sort of how Iceland is run, or at least in theory. There is universal healthcare, there is social platforms, there's parental leave, there's all these types of things that we as a society have decided that we want to invest in. Free schools, all those types of things. So there's some kind of equality built into the system, which is sort of, partly what that value is about. The second value is be raw, which basically means that we want to speak our truth at any given moment without worrying too much about the sugarcoating aspect of it, which can sometimes get in the way. So there's a few of those, and figure it out, which we have a saying in Iceland, which is tetarettast, which is sort of like, this will all work out. You usually say it when it doesn't really look like it will work out. He says, I'll be fine. And having that mentality of being from a small place, being from Iceland, where you don't necessarily have the luxury of having experts in everything. And then you just have to put yourself in that position of saying, I'm going to assume that there's a solution here. And now it's my job to find what that solution is.
At the top of the show, I called you Hallie because I was a little worried about pronouncing your name. How do you pronounce your name?
The full name is Haraldur Ingi Þorleifsson.
Is there a middle? Did you throw in a middle name there?
Sometimes, yeah. I have I have a middle name, Ingi.
Ingi, okay. Haraldur Þorleifsson.
Yeah, but I don't really use the middle name that much.
Okay. You mentioned this on another podcast. I was listening to you on the Dribble podcast. And people can listen to that one if they want a really deep history of your relationship with the Dribble platform. But it does seem like everyone's visiting Iceland these days. It's a beautiful place. I went there a few years ago. My mother is half Swedish, so I have a little bit of like Scandinavian background. I loved reading Snorri Sturluson. Do you know like all the original like Norse mythology? Everything that we know about Norse mythology basically comes from that book, and it was just a really, really inspirational trip. Are you seeing all of your friends from the design community coming out to visit you these days?
I don't know if they're coming to visit me, but they're definitely coming to Iceland. There's a direct flight now from San Francisco.
Yeah.
So we have an office there. There's a huge influx of people from there. There's always been a direct flight from New York. But overall, yeah, there's just the tourist boom has been crazy these last few years. There's been, I think there's 2 million tourists this
wow.
year, if I'm not mistaken, with only about 300,000 people living here. I don't want to say it's too much, but it's definitely getting there.
So when you were starting your career in design, what was your first design client? Do you remember that? Who was the first client that you worked with ever?
I can't remember if this was the first client, but I do remember one very early client, which was a hotel here in Iceland. Some friends of mine had been working. They were hired to do a website for a hotel, and I looked at what they were doing, and I thought that was interesting. So I helped them out with that site, and I think I got paid, you know, probably $100 or something.
And that was how long ago, roughly?
That would have been about 20 years ago.
Wow. So yeah, this is what I was talking about. Like, people come to your website and they're like, "Whoa, Google." It takes a little while. How did you go from building up your relationships with these first clients to getting these big, big clients? What was the progression from then to now?
So 20 years ago, I was in school. I was studying finance. And then I went to study philosophy. And then I took a master's in economics that I didn't really finish. And I studied some other things. And while I was in school, I used design as a way to survive while I was looking for another real career.
When you say survive, what you mean as a paycheck or like emotionally? What do you mean by survive?
As a paycheck.
Yeah.
We have a decent system here in where you can get student loans for cheap, but I didn't want to come out of school with any loans. So I used that to support myself through school. And then I stopped designing quite a few times while I was going to do something else. And but in 2006, I moved to New York to work at a design agency called Human Council, which was a fairly small agency, but they had a lot of really great clients. They were working with Apple. They did the Facebook logo. They were working with Google quite a bit. And while I was there, I met a guy called Phil, and he later went on to found an agency called Upper Quad. And after I had been fired, and actually Phil had been fired too, he reached out to me and said he had some freelance work for Google. And I started freelancing with him. That would have been about 10 years ago, and worked with him for an Upper Quad for a long time. And both through portfolio building, but maybe more importantly, through skill building on those projects, I ended up having a foundation that I could start an agency and do this on my own.
Yeah, I think one of the really challenging things about starting an agency is there's this chicken or egg problem where you have never done work for big companies, and yet, you know, you're trying to get work from big companies. And by big, you know, that definition doesn't have to be Google. It could be, you know, much smaller companies than that are still big clients. And breaking through that chicken or egg problem can be pretty difficult. So working at another company or getting these referrals seems like a big thing. Is there any other trick to that, to getting those clients to trust you in the beginning?
Yeah, it is definitely a chicken and egg problem, because a big client wants to work with someone that has worked with big clients. So you have to have something to point to as to project where you can say, I did something, maybe it wasn't as big, but at least it's in the same ballpark, or it's in a house next to that ballpark. And you kind of need that.
I can see the ballpark from here.
you need you need some kind of a ladder, and you can't jump more than one or two steps at a time. And so, no, there's just a slow progression of you start with small companies, you start working with your friends and your family, and then you get hired to do the website or whatever for the bar you go to or a band your friends are in. And then there's maybe a supermarket, and then do that for long enough, and then you're working with Google.
Yeah, there aren't really that many shortcuts. You kind of have to take it one rung at a time on the ladder. That's what I've found as well. Something that gets spoken of a lot in, you know, design circles and client work is just working with bad clients, having relationships where it's really hard to work through a project, or they're not, you know, listening to your feedback. I guess what I'm wondering is the opposite. What's a good client like? What is it like to work with someone who really trusts you, or what is the type of client you really enjoy working with?
I first want to talk about the bad client, because I think this is something I hear a lot from agency people. And I think it gets used as an excuse and a self-fulfilling prophecy for a lot of people.
Mm.
I think there's this mentality with some agencies that, you know, this job would be great if it wasn't for the clients. And I think that, again, just builds up a dynamic where automatically all the clients become bad. Most clients can be good clients. Well, almost everyone that hires an agency wants to do good work. I don't know why else they would hire an agency. And so it's on you as the expert to educate them on how to work with you. They won't know how to work with an agency. That's not what they do every day, but that's what you do every day. So it's on you to help them, train them, educate them, walk them through this, be patient. But doing that, and then on top of that, delivering great work, they want nothing else than to trust you and for you to take away their concerns and their worries. If you're at a place where they don't trust you and they're being, you know, being too critical or being obsessive about them, something, that's probably because you messed up earlier in the process.
What have you learned about developing that trust early on and educating the client? What are the things? I mean, presumably some of these companies have worked with agencies before. What is it about your process that you're trying to teach them?
I think it's really important to set expectations up front. I think it's really important for you to walk through what is going to happen at each step of the process. It's important for you to tell them what their role in the project is, because they have a role and they have a big role. And it's important for you to explain to them what your role is, meaning the agency. I think it's very important to spend the time up front to know them as people. That's what the thing that you need to fall back on. If the relationship isn't there, the hard conversations become impossible. But if the relationship is there, you have a foundation to solve whatever the problem is. Most of these are not design agency client related, by the way. These are mostly just human rules of engagement.
Do you find that over the past, you know, 10, 20 years throughout your career, there has been an increase in the like level of quality that people expect out of the design that company have? It seems like that's got to be a yes, but I don't know how you feel about it.
I think so. I think one of the great things about the internet is everyone sees really quality work, or with apps or whatever it is. You see really great work and you aspire, whoever you are, you're going to aspire to that. I've been in meetings with people that have $1,000 budget and Apple.com is the reference.
Mm-hmm.
And again, that's fantastic to have those kind of aspirations, but then it becomes a question of level setting and expectation setting of what is it about the thing that you're aspiring to that makes it exciting? And what are the things that we honestly can't do, because $1,000 only goes so far?
I agree with exactly what you're saying. And I think that especially when you have this relationship as a human being with the internet, with the apps, you see everything is getting just a little bit more polished and refined all the time. A lot of that work is coming from in-house design teams. And I think that the idea of in-house design when I was going through school, was not as well respected as design agency work. That agencies were where you could do maybe more creative stuff or have a chance to work on a lot of different things. Now I'm seeing that it's evened out a little bit more, and that there's an expectation that especially software companies, but basically any company, can become a strong design group. Have you found that to be true? And also, how does that affect the agency relationship? Is it harder to get clients today, or not at all?
I think, as with anything, there's pros and cons. So you have pros, definitely are that you have clients that are extremely well educated and have extremely strong teams that add a ton of value to the project. So some of our best clients are clients that have, like Facebook, that have, or you know, any number of these clients that have internal teams that are exceptional. And when you work with a group of people like that, everything you do becomes elevated. It becomes better. They push you harder. They know what will work. They've tried a bunch of stuff in the past. And the con, potentially, from a hypothetical business side, would be that you get less work. But I think it's just a different type of work, and it's a different world. We certainly haven't found there's less work. There's actually, you know, there's a bigger need because of this.
Because the expectations are going up.
Yeah, and but also because you can adjust your model. I think there's less work for agencies, you know, the old time agencies that wanted to own the whole process and wanted to be these the savior that comes in and solves the problem. I think that is in the past for sure. So we look at our clients as partners and collaborators, and we want to be an extension rather than an outside team.
Yeah, it's interesting to think about the evolution of that relationship from just being this like completely external thing that designs the whole thing and then hands it over to you. And I think that's where a lot of the frustration around like the client design relationship was problematic, because you would hand off this thing and then the client would always, you know, end up screwing it up. But if you're more of an extension, then maybe you have a closer relationship. From these companies that do have strong internal design resources and great teams, what are the projects that make sense for you to tackle?
Yeah, before we get to that, I just want to, because you said it, I think what was happening in the past and happens still when clients, as you say, mess things up, it's not that they're messing it up. It was actually the agency that messed it up in the delivery, and they didn't deliver what the client needed. And then the client was in this bad position of having to hack together a solution to the actual problem that you didn't solve. The best projects for us right now, to answer your question, the best clients range from, well, there's maybe three main things that we look at when we look at a project. There's the people that we're going to be working with, meaning the team, not the brand. But secondly, there is definitely the brand. And then there's the budget and the timeline, meaning is there enough runway to do really great, exceptional work. When we have all three, we feel really good. When we don't, we try and leverage up one of them.
I guess what I'm wondering is, if I'm Slack or Facebook or Airbnb and I've got great designers on my team, how do I decide that it's time to hire Wenno? What is it about the relationship that I'm going to get that I can't get from my own internal team?
There's a few different scenarios. So one of them could be purely about your team being busy on other things. You have a strong internal team, but you have too many projects and you want to get more done than you can with the internal team. So that's number one. I think number two is you automatically have a fresh perspective.
Yeah.
When you bring in an outside agency, you have someone that doesn't know all the reasons why something won't work and therefore will try them again in a different way. They're not blocked by the internal truths that have been built up and aren't necessarily true. Or you have a project that you don't have the internal skill sets to do. For whatever reason, you have maybe a strong product team, but you don't have a team that's worked on this type of product, or it hasn't worked on branding, or it hasn't worked on any kind of marketing aspects.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. Bringing in that fresh perspective is always extremely valuable. So that totally makes sense to me. I wonder, you know, as you've grown your company, does Wenno have its own like process of working with clients that's well-defined, or do you let people kind of take it in different directions depending on the project?
The only process that we have is built around close relationships, meaning the only thing I really believe that is required for us to do great work is if we have smart people that are hardworking, they have smart people that are hardworking. The only thing we need to do is get those groups of people to work closely together. And the only way to do that is if we have them work really closely together, meaning in the same physical space, but at least communicating as much as possible and building up not just professional, but also personal relationships.
Do you find that Wenno has an in-house style or something that people come to you with a certain expectation? I find that when I visit your website, there's a certain cohesiveness across all of the projects where I feel like I'm going to get something that feels clean and maybe colorful. I don't know. Is there something like that that you find people expect when they come to you?
I think there is, but I really want to get out of that. I don't want us to be the place that does a particular type of design. I think a design is about solving some kind of a problem, and our role is then to find that problem and then solve it in the best possible way. For most problems, though, having something clean and easy to understand works pretty well.
Yeah.
That's a pretty good starting point. I don't think clutter ever solves anything. So there's probably a reason why some of those things start to feel like they live in the same world. They have the sort of the same ethos around them, but visually I don't want us to have a particular style.
So there's something like 60 people at Wenno currently?
Yeah.
Is that 30 plus designers, or what's the ratio of designers versus the rest of the company, project managers and all these different support roles?
There's probably about 30 designers, about 15 developers, maybe about 8 or so producers, 6 to 8. There's a content team, meaning people that do photography, videos, those types of things. And then there are people that focus more on the operational side, like the finance team. We have a team called the People Experience Team, and then client relationship teams.
You mentioned to me before we started recording that you're restructuring the company. What does that mean? How are you envisioning that?
This is the first time I've actually been a manager to anyone.
Mm-hmm.
Did it briefly 20 years ago, but apart from that, I wouldn't call that management. I've never built a company. I've never been a manager. There's a lot of interesting phases that a company goes through that I wasn't fully aware of, even though I did, I have some outside resources and outside help. But I found that as we grew up, the structure that we had, which was mostly built around me, wasn't sustainable. I had 17 reports at one point, and that obviously just meant that I wasn't really managing anyone or really doing anything that well. So a few weeks ago, we tried to restructure the company with a few main goals in mind, including having as much autonomy in each office as possible. So that we created a studio lead, for example, in San Francisco, and she oversees the whole creative team, meaning designers, developers, and so on. We brought in a managing director to oversee all the operations of the company. And we made a lot of changes that ultimately got my reports down to 5. And what we're hoping will happen is that each department, each team, and each office is a lot more nimble and flexible and can make their own decisions without everything leveling up to one person.
What was the decision to open other offices in the first place?
That was never really a decision. That was kind of a given for me. Me and my wife, we traveled the world for a few years, and I always wanted to maintain that lifestyle in some form, and having multiple offices helps with that. But ultimately, the business reason is that, like I mentioned before, we believe that the best work happens when we're as close as possible to our clients. So we try, and if there is enough of projects in a specific location, we'll try and set up an office there so we can work as closely as possible with the client.
How do you as a company group around common goals and common projects? Is it something where you're able to work remotely with tools like Slack, or like, what do you use to keep the whole company on the same page?
We have a few, I mean, that's constant conversation, but we have a few tools. The obvious ones like Slack, we use Asana for sort of the project management aspect of things. We have weekly all hands meetings where we present either projects or ideas or whatever it is that we want to rally people around. We have a retreat every year. That's 1 week, like I mentioned before, where we come together, we work together for a few days, and then we go off into the countryside usually for a few more days. We have small gimmicky things like having each office has a camera and then an iPad on the wall, so you can see the other offices. And just the idea, the hope that I had with that is you at least remember there's more people than just your office. It is hard for people to have a connection with someone that isn't physically there. So there are things that we have to work around.
Some companies like Spotify has this interesting model where they try to have cross-functional teams, but also teams or groups of people who do the same function across different teams. So all of your different designers are in a group together. All of your different developers are in a group together so that they can share knowledge. And that becomes, it seems like, harder and harder as you're more and more geographically spread out.
I mean, even at just 60 people, that becomes tough. So I don't know how someone like Spotify does that. I'm starting to believe more and more in having just really, really strong local teams. Hmm. Working across time zones and offices slows things down. And if you have to keep people in the loop about everything that is happening 7 hours ahead or behind you, that just becomes very challenging. And decisions become harder to make.
What have you learned about allowing creativity to flourish in bigger and bigger companies? I think, you know, creativity is a very difficult thing to define. Like having creative ideas, creating interesting work, stuff that's going to excite the client and surprise them and be fulfilling to you, and also meet the like level of expectation that someone in the New York office needs to feel like what's happening in the Los Angeles office is equally good. How do you develop that as you continue to grow?
When I started the company, I was mostly worried about that. I was mostly worried that it would be very hard for us to set a standard, and with every project that we make, that we live up to that standard, and that we always deliver great work. To my surprise, that was the easiest part. We just hired some really great designers, and we gave them a lot of freedom, and they continued to create great work. The harder parts were the things you mentioned before about logistics, about operations, about scaling, about culture. Like those are really the hard parts. The output for us has never been a challenge.
You've been experimenting with some physical products lately. You're making a stool, you're making a lamp. What's all that about?
I think when you're a company and you're a CEO, you're supposed to have strategic reasons for doing things. And it's very hard to say that you're doing something because you want to do it. But I also think there's no better reason for doing anything than just wanting to do it. So I just want to do it.
You want to make a stool, for example?
I do.
I went to industrial design school making furniture all day, so I get it.
Yeah.
What makes you want to make a stool?
We work in digital all day, and it's super interesting. There's new challenges. There's a bit of a humanness that's missing to it. It's not something you can touch. It gets outdated really, really, really fast. And so you don't really have anything that sort of lasts and lives on. So I really like new objects. One of the reasons I like setting up a new office is I like to decorate it.
Uh-huh.
I like to design the space. I have a relatively small home, so I can't really buy new furniture at home. But I can get away with buying new furniture for our offices. So I like things, and I like beautiful things, and I think we can make really nice things.
Well, I'm seeing the video feed here from Iceland, and I can see the background is very beautiful. What's your interior design philosophy, or how do you approach that?
For me, the office is really an extension of our brand. So I want you to go through our brand experience in a website and then come to our office and feel like this makes sense.
Hmm.
So we have really clean, functional furniture with good breathing space. And then usually we have pops of color and something to make things interesting and warm and inviting.
Do you allow that to be interpreted different ways at different offices? It sounds like that's a fun part of it for you.
There's definitely something that ties them all together. For example, we have the same desk chairs in all the offices. We have the same desks actually in San Francisco and in LA and in Iceland. We have different desks in New York, but they're very similar. And then we have some of the furniture pieces are the same, but mostly they are sort of objects that could live together without necessarily being the same object.
Are there companies that you go to for that you really like in the world of furniture that you look up to that, or that you like to buy their products to outfit your offices?
One of my favorite furniture brands is called Muto, M-U-U-T-O.
Yeah.
I think they're fantastic. There's Hay is another one. A lot of these are sort of Scandinavian based, clean, functional, but still slightly friendly and approachable.
Are there companies in general outside of furniture that you look up to visually, aesthetically, that you think are doing great work that inspire you?
My ultimate client is Lego. That's the client that I really want to work for and work with, not necessarily for aesthetics, but mostly just for. Mm. For brand reasons. I think they've built an exceptional brand around a very simple idea. They've grown it really, really well.
Yeah, I love Legos. I played with them growing up a lot, and it's such a powerful thing. I was meeting up with one of my cousins recently, and I hadn't seen him for pretty much 15 years. And when he was growing up, you know, I was about 15 years older than him. So I like played Legos with him and built stuff with him. And it was kind of my first experience of having like the opposite relationship of more, you know, a parent and child, even though he was my much younger cousin. It's like such a special bonding experience to see him like again, 15 years later. That's all we talked about was Legos. And it's such an amazing thing. And I feel like all day long, all I'm doing is really pretty much an adult version of Legos, which is like gluing different pieces of code together or, you know, design ideas together. It is really powerful in a lot of ways.
It's philosophically, it's powerful. I think executionally, it's powerful. I think you can build anything with Legos. And if you're a child or an adult, the same idea holds. I can play with Legos with my daughter now, and it's fun. And I used to do it all the time when I was a kid.
I want to go into a personal direction as we wrap up. You mentioned at the very beginning of the show that you struggled with alcoholism for a little while. I'm curious if there are things from that that you learned that people, you know, it's something a lot of people struggle with, and people struggle with similar types of things in their life. But you built an incredible company coming out of that. How did you make that change in your life?
So I didn't really have any problems with alcohol for a very long time. But then about maybe 10, 12 years ago, I started to drink pretty heavily and more. And then ultimately, I was drinking every day for a few years, or more or less every day. And I got drunk pretty much every day. And so it was a huge problem. And I had to reassess my life. And I thought, I can either do that for a little bit and not do anything else, or I can stop. So I just decided that I would stop, and I decided to take 1 week where I would drink as much as I wanted, and then I stopped drinking. And then about a year after that, my daughter was born, and then about a year after that, I started Ueno. I think the main thing is that there is there's always a way back, that there is a way for you to stop doing what you're doing if you really want to. And there's no mistake that you've made that isn't fixable.
Yeah. In general, you know, you mentioned something at the beginning of the of the show, which was that you want to, I guess it sounds like you like to take things to their extreme. You like to take, you mentioned not wanting to drink coffee because you'd be afraid you couldn't stop and you'd be too wired. With Ueno, you're building an incredible company really quickly, and the extreme of that seems like a positive thing for the world. What's your dream for where that can be in the long term?
I think there is externally, the positive outcomes are what you're talking about. I think I just want to quickly touch on the negative outcomes. Internally, there's definitely, with something that's growing this fast and that has the bar that I want to set for the company, there's definitely a lot of people internally, and myself included, that have to work extremely hard for that to happen. And just like with alcoholism or the coffee or anything, sometimes that can be taken to extremes. I think I have a tendency to do that, and the company is no exception. The hope for the company is that we will, in the next few years, grow into about 200 people, and we'll grow into a place where the work we do goes beyond just the digital space, even though that's something that I really want to keep doing. But we also grow into new offices, new locations, and obviously new clients.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really inspiring. And I think that sometimes I joke with my team that the experience that I found the hardest in my life was just being a teenager. Like, a lot of the stuff that I experience on a day-to-day basis, like, the stakes are so much higher with what we're doing at Lumi, and you know, big problems come up, hopefully not that often, but they happen. And I still would rather have all of the challenges and pain points that we have today than like going back to being in high school. And I think, you know, getting through those things, getting through those hard times, like you getting to the other side of this like period of your life, it kind of makes you feel like you can do anything. As much as you wish maybe you didn't lose some years of your life there, maybe not being as productive or excited about what you were doing as you could have been, it maybe taught you something that allows you to build Ueno into the company that it couldn't have been.
I think that's true. It was, I mean, I've had situations in my life. I lost my mom when I was 11. I've had depression and other things that have come up for me. And so in the grand scheme of things, the worst thing can happen with a company is not that bad. And we have extremely competent people. So again, the worst came to worst. The only thing that would happen is that a few people would have to change their jobs. And that's not that bad.
Yeah. It's really good to hear you say that, because I do think, you know, a lot of people struggle with these types of things, and it's just not something that gets talked about very much.
One of the things that I sometimes tell myself or tell other people is, I think the people that work here have to simultaneously carry two ideas. One being that everything we do is extremely important and we need to do it as well as possible. And the second one being that none of this really matters.
I feel exactly the same way. I call it optimistic nihilism.
Right. And, you know, we want to go all in and, you know, on all of these things, but we also need to understand that this is not really what life is about.
Yeah. Well, if people want to learn more about Ueno, if they maybe are a client who's looking for a great design agency to work with, they can go to ueno.com. If you're looking for a job, if you want to be one of those 200 people, you have an incredible video game. Maybe this goes back to your roots as like a Flash developer or something, but you have a little game that I actually played through the whole thing because I wanted to see how it ended. It's like a little Flash game or something that is in the browser that you need to do to apply to Ueno. Is that still going? I played it when it was first released.
Yeah, you don't have to go through it, but it is a way for you to understand a little bit about the things that we think are important. Like I said before, at the end of it, you kind of realize that none of it is really important.
And then you're really wondering why you're applying to this company.
Yeah.
What else do you want to point people to if they want to learn more about you and your company?
We have a ton of social accounts. I won't plug them. They're all on our website. But, you know, the biggest need we have at any given moment is more smart people to work with. So if anyone out there is looking for a new job, I encourage them to take a look at our site.
Thank you so much, Holly. It was great speaking to you.
Thank you so much. It was nice to meet you as well.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed the show, if you got something useful out of it, I would love to hear what that was. Consider writing a short review, could be just a sentence long, by going to iTunes and searching for Well Made. I want to hear it all. I want to hear good, bad. I want to hear your constructive criticisms. I am just trying to make this show as useful as possible for you. So tell us what you think. That is the very best way that you can support the show. Thanks, and see you next time.